Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Based on the 1960s television series of the same name, The Fugitive in 1993 was a pulse-pounding, intelligent thriller that defied all odds considering its precarious production. Thrown together last minute, filmed without a finished script, with the actors mostly making everything up, it was a train wreck waiting to happen. A one-way ticket to a shit show.
The name, Dr. Richard Kimble. The destination, Death Row State Prison. The irony, Richard Kimble is innocent.
And on August 29th, 1967, Richard Kimble, convicted for murdering his wife, on the run since his train derailed, was finally going to prove his innocence. For four seasons of ABC's The Fugitive, Kimble dodged Police Lieutenant Philip Gerard while in search of the one-armed man he saw fleeing the night of his wife's death. That night, after 120 episodes, 78 million households tuned in to see his fate. By comparison, recent hit shows like The Big Bang Theory ended with 18 million. Game of Thrones, 19 million. It was a record not broken until the finale of MASH in 1983. The Fugitive left a lasting impact on Arnold Copelson, a producer on everything from Porky's to Platoon. He spent a decade wanting to get The Fugitive on the big screen, and it was the perfect time. Much like how movies today are literal ads.
Oh, we're the Mario Brothers.
Tetris, it's called a Blackberry.
Hi, Barbie.
Hi, Barbie.
Hi, Barbie.
In the early 90s, film adaptations of television series were da bomb. From The Addams Family and Dragnet to The Beverly Hillbillies and even SNL sketches like Wayne's World.
It's like people only do things because they get paid. And that's just really sad.
Copelson's dilemma, though, was that he didn't have the rights to The Fugitive. The series creator, Roy Huggins, still did. Huggins was sitting on the option of making a film until he figured out a compelling way to adapt it. As the show was more about Kimble helping others and their problems and never able to fix his. A movie would need to be more concise and layered. Unable to figure it out, he gave producer Keith Barish the rights and Copelson immediately called him to team up for a film. But not just one. They wanted a franchise. The Fugitive went through a murderer's row of 80s action writers. Lethal Weapon 3's Robert Kamen, 48 Hours' Larry Gross, Aliens' David Giller, and Walter Hill, writer-director of The Warriors, 48 Hours, Red Heat, Streets of Fire, among many other classics. Hill came aboard to direct after Dangerous Liaisons director Stephen Frears left.
It's beyond my control.
Copelson approached a few stars to play Kimble, including a disinterested Harrison Ford. Walter Hill wanted Alec Baldwin, but Warner Brothers didn't think Baldwin was a big enough star to draw audiences. Hill eventually walked. And this wouldn't be the first time Ford would replace Baldwin.
I will f***ing destroy you.
Yes, sir.
As time went on, the screenplay was devolving into a more subversive territory than what Warner Brothers was looking for.
The version I first read, Tommy Lee Jones had hired the one-armed man to kill Harrison because Harrison had messed up an operation on his wife after he had beat her up.
Out of ideas, Culberson turned to David Toohey. He wrote Warlock, the schlocky horror flick Culberson was currently producing. The two men bickered throughout production until the producer fired Toohey, only for the studio to rehire him. In the midst of their reconciliation, a desperate Culberson asked Toohey if he'd be interested in writing The Fugitive. Toohey remembered the very Les Mis-like series and took the job. Toohey's script concerned a disgruntled one-armed miner that lost his arm during a mine collapse, and in revenge kills the coal baron's daughter, who is also Kimball's wife. All of that was obviously discarded, but most of the action beats are Toohey's. The prison transport erupting into a gunfight, Kimball saving a guard before the train collides into the bus, running into that same guard at the hospital, Gerard's commanding introduction, Kimball stealing an ambulance, the chase forcing a jump off of a waterfall, this time Niagara Falls, and later Kimball's investigation taking him to a lockup, seeing the wrong man, a joke about cable,
there ain't no cable in this damn place,
running into Gerard at the stairwell, and Gerard in full trigger happy mode as Kimball's foot is stuck in the security door. Toohey departed in 1992. Warner Brothers then met with diehard screenwriter Jeb Stuart, and they didn't like what he had to say.
The idea basically said it's not a serial, it's a one shot movie. If he's accused of killing his wife, I want to solve that. I want to make that a thriller. I want to make that the whole story is about proving not running away from the electric chair, but proving that he did kill his wife. And for some reason, Warner Brothers thought that was really sucked as an idea.
Months later, Culberson had somehow bagged another meeting with Harrison Ford. He came around on the project, but only if it was a single contained film. Suddenly, Jeb Stuart's one-off idea didn't sound so bad. They hired Stuart to pitch his ideas to Ford at his home, and Ford agreed.
As the project developed, I saw the potential for the film I think we made, which, and you'll not hear me say this so often, which I think is a damn good movie.
Getting one of the biggest stars on the planet onto their picture came with an urgent caveat. Ford's availability was extremely narrow. Production needed to start by the beginning of 1993. And for added pressure, Warner Brothers had a hard deadline of releasing the movie on August 6th of that year. Now they needed a director and a script. In October of 1992 came the release of Under Siege, the Steven Seagal action classic? Seagal agreed to the film reluctantly after he was promised by director Andrew Davis that he wouldn't have much screen time. Despite that, or rather because of it, the above-average Die Hard ripoff was a big financial and somewhat critical hit for Warner Brothers. Culberson thoroughly enjoyed it, and at the premiere shook hands with Davis, cryptically telling him, "I know what your next film will be." Less than a week later, Davis got a call that Harrison Ford, whose contract gave him director approval, had just seen Under Siege, and he wanted Davis for The Fugitive. With Davis behind the wheel, fixing the script became the first order of business. Again, Stuart thought the other drafts focused too much on Kimball being on the run, when the heart of the story should be him trying to prove his innocence, in the place where it happened. Ford and Davis chose their hometown of Chicago, because they wouldn't have to spend any time location scouting.
I knew what it offered in terms of architecture, in terms of the reality of a doctor and what we could use with the facilities at all the different hospitals and the institutions of Chicago medical world. And I had done four movies already in Chicago.
Davis from the get knew Gerard had to be played by Tommy Lee Jones. The two were friends, and on Under Siege, Davis smartly let Jones hijack Steven Seagal's own movie.
All of my life, Saturday morning cartoons. Best.
Imagine what Jones could do with a real talent like Ford. For Jeb Stuart, he never wanted Gerard to be a villain. Instead, just a good man that's good at his job. If that was the case, who would the one-armed man be working for? There needed to be a larger conspiracy at play to give the plot that extra dimension that Roy Huggins could never figure out. Davis turned to his sister, a nurse. She suggested a new drug protocol that Kimball wouldn't endorse. Davis and Stuart had all the pieces of the puzzle and were ready to go, until they were blindsided by Warner Brothers mandating that Kimball have a love interest. And not a simple tryst either, someone that joined him on the run. Julianne Moore's character was then introduced. Kimball seeks refuge at her apartment, they play shower hanky-panky, and she's with him till the end. 2 weeks before shooting, two major shakeups took place. Warner Brothers fired Davis's cinematographer and close friend, Frank Tidy. While he was replaced by Michael Chapman, of Taxi Driver and Raging Bull fame, the two hated each other. Chapman tried to quit, but Warner Brothers forced him to stay.
I was very unhappy all the way through it. Just was a very bad mix. It just didn't work. And I used to say to them, look, I haven't cashed the check yet. I'll give you the money back. Just let me out of here, please. I'm begging you.
The second change was Davis finally speaking up about Kimball shacking up with another woman while still mourning the death of his wife. It didn't sit right with him, and he told Copelson they were cutting it all, as it would have ruined the film. Moore was devastated losing such a breakout role, but her diminished part served as a valuable homage to the TV series, with Kimball choosing to help others despite his circumstances.
How's the boy doing?
He saved his life.
Between that back and forth, Jeb Stuart only completed one draft before cameras started rolling. While it was structurally similar to the final product, he hadn't nailed down the characters yet, so they were paper thin and their dialogue was robotic. Worst of all, it didn't really have an ending.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Production started in February of 1993. Seeing how the script was still very much evolving, Davis chose to film the scenes mostly in order, giving Stuart time to fix things as they went along. They started in North Carolina, because it was the first state that agreed to let them derail a train.
We engineered the tracks so they would go off in different directions. There were no rehearsals. There was no possibility of a second take.
After a short delay, thanks to a tornado warning, action was called at 3 a.m., 16 cameras filmed the chaos, and 13 survived. That $1.5 million showstopper was filmed entirely with a real train. Well, that's what Warner Brothers wanted us to believe. In a crude practice that still happens today, looking at you, Top Gun Maverick, the studio wanted the press surrounding the film to be about how no visual effects were used.
Well, we weren't allowed to talk about it. You mentioned that there was visual effects on the movie. Warner Brothers had it in our contract, you know, because we did crash a train. Unfortunately, it didn't work.
The collision into the bus was all full scale, but the train cars popping off the track happened too early, so the footage wasn't usable. Miniatures, which were always part of the plan, were used to fill in the rest, and they were absolutely essential for the front projection sequences with Ford running from the train. That said, you can visit the real crash site to this day.
Well, I fell. I did. I fell coming down the hill, planted face first into the ground. I hope it was worth it. Oh my gosh, we're at the train crash from The Fugitive. And it really is treacherous here. There's so many ways you could trip and fall.
Standing in the wreckage, Davis was ordered to film something for a teaser trailer to build buzz, since Warner Brothers hadn't a clue what this movie would end up being. Marketing dug up Gerard's opening speech from David Toohey's script and handed it to Tommy Lee Jones. He revised it and begrudgingly filmed one straight to camera, surrounded by extras.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, listen up. We have a fugitive that's been on the run for 90 minutes.
Davis actually liked what Jones did, ran it again with the other U.S. Marshals, and Jones put a little more effort into it.
Listen up, ladies and gentlemen. Our fugitive has been on the run for 90 minutes.
The final cut combines the two takes.
Your fugitive's name is Dr. Richard Kimball.
There must be some sort of error. There are 9 fugitives, and none of them are named Kimball.
I didn't kill my wife!
What?
No, you're supposed to go, I don't care!
I don't care.
Let the manhunt begin!
The other thing marketing wanted was clips of Harrison Ford running through the woods. In doing so, Ford tore his right ACL. Surgery and 6 weeks of recovery would wait till he was finished filming. In the meantime, painkillers. They had just started, and now Ford would visibly limp throughout the rest of production. The shot of Kimball dropping into the ravine to avoid the runaway train? Ford did the jump once, but the pyrotechnics didn't go off in time. He was in so much pain, he protested doing it again. Visual effects supervisor William Massa was simultaneously working on Peter Weir's Fearless. He knew Ford and Weir were close after Witness and the Mosquito Coast. Massa asked Weir if he could come talk with Ford. Weir visited the set, sat with Ford, and raised his spirits just enough to do a second and final take. When the first dailies started coming in, Warner Brothers was furious to find out that Ford was filming with a beard, as they were paying for that face. Luckily, by sheer nature of the plot, having Ford slash Kimball shave his beard made sense. Quick turns like that became the norm as production developed into big budget improv. On each given day, Davis knew where a scene started and needed to end, but outside of that, it was a free-for-all. According to multiple cast and crew, around 70% of the dialogue was improvised. Jones knew he and his fellow U.S. Marshals were extremely one-note placeholders. So he encouraged them to develop their own lines, banter throughout their scenes, and have fun doing it. Yes, the irony is self-evident. If they did that, their portions of the film would be fun to shoot, or at the very least in the film itself, be watchable. Nearly every word among them was made up on the day.
What are you doing?
I'm thinking.
Well, think me up a cup of coffee and a chocolate donut with some of those little sprinkles on top.
No, we're going to send you a bunch of cops. I want you to make sure they turn that place inside out.
You got it.
Don't let them give you any shit about your ponytail either.
Vascular surgeon? What the hell is that?
Somebody that makes more money than you.
Way to go!
You got to get a Peter Pan right here off of this dam right here.
If they can dye this river green today, why can't they dye it blue the other 364 days of the year?
Sammy.
Yeah?
When I die, I want to come back just like you.
No, you mean happy and handsome? Well, why don't you say strange or weird? I mean, hinky, that has no meaning.
Well, we say hinky.
I don't want you guys using words around me that got no meaning. I'm taking the stairs and walking.
As for Gerard's famous I don't care line,
I didn't kill my wife! I don't care!
The story differs from who's telling it, from Jones consolidating a longer speech to Stewart giving it to him directly. But it does exist in Walter Hill's older script. During Ford's parts, before filming any scene with another actor, he would take them aside and completely rewrite their lines.
We went to his trailer and we worked it out. We worked the scene out. You know, you say this and then I'll say that. Okay, and then I'll say this and you say that. Because he didn't like how it was written. So we worked it out and we came back in. And he's kind of a cranky guy. And he was like, we're going to do it this way. And everyone went, all right.
The buck stops here.
When they got to the City Hall chase, it had two issues. The first was Gerard shooting at Kimball. Jones rejected the idea that a U.S. Marshal would open fire inside a crowded hallway, endangering innocent bystanders. Ford and Davis attempted to persuade him otherwise, but Jones refused and locked himself in his trailer.
I don't bargain.
Jeb Stuart was called in to help, and he impatiently said to Jones, I'm just going to tell you what the audience is seeing, because we're cutting this right now. Less than 5 minutes ago, you just shot an African-American man at point-blank range, and yet this rich, white doctor, you're not even going to pull your gun out? How does that work? What are the optics of that? Stewart stormed out without hearing a response. Hours later, Jones unloaded clip after clip. But then what? The script conveniently had Kimball disappear after getting out of the security door. Davis needed something bigger to cement the idea of Gerard looking for a Kimball-sized needle in the haystack of Chicago. As luck of the Irish would have it, the annual St. Patrick's Day parade was weeks away and Davis wanted in. The city gave them permission to walk with the Plumbers Union, and Warner Brothers was never told their plan. With no rehearsal time, production winged it.
We didn't stage anything. I just inserted myself in the middle of the parade, and we grabbed some free shots, and it was a pretty interesting way to work. And actually, because I had black hair and I looked a little different, I wasn't really recognized for a little while.
Everything was barreling toward the movie's climax, but Stewart had yet to figure out the ending. The current idea had Kimball jumping on a subway train and Gerard driving onto the tracks in pursuit. Not only was that unfeasible in the time they had, it also didn't match the film they were making. Stewart's deadline was coming up and he couldn't figure out how to combine all the threads. The night before, banging his head against the wall, he gave up. At 2 in the morning, he lay down defeated. Then it hit him. Janitor. A hotel convention. Kimball could publicly confront the man who had his wife killed.
And he bursts in the ballroom and he goes, "You switched the samples and you doctored your research so that you could have Provasic." Anyway, so it's that ballroom. So we walk into that ballroom.
But before they could film this new hotel conclusion, they needed a new Dr. Charles Nichols, originally played by Richard Jordan. Having filmed only a handful of his scenes, Jordan was diagnosed with an inoperable brain tumor and understandably chose to leave. He died 3 weeks after The Fugitive came to theaters. He was replaced by Yaron Krabbe, who was given a 12-hour notice to fly from Holland to Chicago, driven straight to set, shook hands with Harrison Ford, put through hair and makeup, then was handed a script. They reshot all the scenes with Nichols, including the opening fundraiser, where Ford now needed a fake beard. Director Andrew Davis had 10 weeks to edit the entire film before its release, in the age of analog editing. It took 6 editors in 7 editing bays with 16 assistants working over 14-hour days for 6 days a week. When the first cut came in at over 3 hours, they had to get brutal, literally and figuratively. The opening fundraiser, Kimball's surgery, his arrival home, his fight with the one-armed man, and his lengthy trial were all chopped down to mere seconds. And anything superfluous, like Kimball buying hair dye, were tossed. But they finished it in time.
You know I'm glad. I need the rest.
Davis and Ford sat down for a screening with Warner Brothers executives. For nearly its entire production, Ford feared this was going to be one of his biggest failures. However, the moment the interrogation scene finished, Ford knew that audiences would care about Kimball's plight, and that the film would work. He leaned over and kissed Davis. The Fugitive released... released. On August 6th, 1993, reviews called it gripping and effective, a taut nail-biter that puts characters first. It reaffirmed Harrison Ford's quintessential everyman persona, and was a star-making turn for Tommy Lee Jones. On a budget of $44 million, it grossed $183 million in the United States and was a sizable hit overseas. The film was number one at the box office for 6 straight weekends, a rare feat then and now. It was an instant classic and now is a remnant of a time when Hollywood still delivered smart, well-made, mid-budgeted, character-driven films, action or otherwise. It was nominated for 7 Academy Awards, including Michael Chapman for Best Cinematography.
And all the time I bitched and complained and said I hated being there and I was the wrong guy and then cursed and this and that. And it all worked out. So, you know, you never know.
All 6 editors for Best Editing, Best Picture, again, a rarity for action thrillers, and Tommy Lee Jones won Best Supporting Actor.
The only thing a man can say at a time like this is, I am not really bald.
The Fugitive got lucky. Much like Jaws or Iron Man, the talent involved surprisingly overcame the tight deadline, studio meddling, and endless other obstacles to make a great film. But it didn't have to be that way. For every Fugitive, there are dozens of Fantastic Fours, Quantum of Solaces, Justice Leagues, Rogue Ones, Hobbitses, Iron Man 2s, Jurassic Park 3s, Superman 4s. Hell, it's our whole channel. Situations where studios force a production start and a finalized release date long before they have a script, let alone a good one. They'll ignore quality in favor of fiscal quarters and executive bonuses. What they don't seem to realize is that we moviegoers don't care when a movie comes out. We've seen foul-mouthed superheroes on Valentine's Day, disturbing revenge thrillers on Christmas, and sat through a 3-hour theoretical physics lecture in the dead heat of summer. We just want good movies. So delay the film, wait for a better script, finish your VFX, and we'll gladly give you our money. Thank you so much for listening. It Was a Shit Show is researched and produced by me, Ian Jench. Sound editing and mix by Ray Reynolds. Our theme music is by Ryan K. Hudson. Wardrobe provided by Clint's Closet. If you're enjoying the show, you can support us on Patreon or help spread the word by leaving a review and forcing your friends and family to listen. And if you have a shit show suggestion, find us on social media at It Was a Shit Show, but shit without the I. You can also find all these episodes on our YouTube channel.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.